Good morning. This is Laurie Mercier with Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're 1 year past the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day, but we don't seem to be any closer to addressing the global ecological crisis facing us. Many are calling for environmentalists to return to Earth Day's roots of anger and activism, facing the crisis with more urgency, not awe and celebration. And more are calling to make fundamental changes to our economic system to not only save the planet, but improve everyone's quality of life. As one of the original organizers of the 1970 Earth Day, Dennis Hayes, said, "Our goal is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all human beings and all other creatures. An environment without ugliness, without poverty, without discrimination, without hunger, and without war. Our goal is a decent environment in its deepest and broadest sense." And last year, Greta Thunberg made a prominent statement against the fairy tales of endless economic growth in her speech to the UN Climate Summit.
"People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth."
Capitalism and most everything in our system depends on accelerated growth. But today, Joe and I want to talk about the principles of degrowth and how it is fundamental to efforts to save the planet and also provides exciting possibilities for activists worldwide. So Joe, you've been thinking and reading a lot about degrowth and in the past have contributed segments to the Old Mole that consider some fundamental reorientations and practices that can help us reimagine an alternative economy. So tell us something about degrowth, its origins, and what it is.
Well, degrowth is both an old idea in a lot of ways, and then as a term, it goes to the French movement that is called décroissance, which is a term coined by political economist, radical leftist André Gorz. And it's come into prominence since the 1990s as a kind of counter-hegemonic point de capitaine, a new kind of signifier of how to reorder society in a way that is going to persist and is going to mean the end of many kinds of oppression and exploitation around the world, both human and non-human. The concern with growth has been, you know, as old as early capitalism in the 17th and 18th century. And even in Marx's critique of capitalism, there's a recognition of the fundamental tendency towards overproduction in the capitalist system and its need to constantly expand its circuits of production, distribution, and consumption. More recently, in the last 10 or 20 years, there has been a network of scholars and activists who have elevated degrowth in order to try and bring together a variety of issues that require action, especially though to avert runaway climate change and ecological collapse. And this focuses on the degrowth of the economy. And it's kind of twofold. On the one hand, it's attacking the idea of growth of GDP, gross domestic product. And it's also practically pointing out the need to reduce and degrow the economy as a system of material extraction and transformation and pollution and waste production. And it is bringing our attention to how the possibility of feeding everyone and providing for the full spectrum of human needs is already in our hands. And that in order to both avert climate catastrophes and to right the historic wrongs that capitalism has globalized, we need to degrow that economy. And what that practically looks like is eliminating inequalities and distributing wealth as a funding mechanism for transforming the economy itself away from growth and capitalism.
Well, I love that the French term for degrowth is about liberation, about not shrinking, as many of the critics of degrowth have claimed, but more this narrative of freedom. And I'm wondering if, because there have been critics on the left of degrowth, for example, Noam Chomsky claimed that it would be a non-starter just because this term growth has such positive connotations in our culture and our vocabulary. So I'm wondering how you respond to these critics, especially those critics on the left who believe that it's not an effective way for mobilizing people to this new kind of culture and economy of degrowth.
Well, there's the kind of criticism you mentioned coming from Noam Chomsky, but then there are a lot of left economists and eco-modernists who argue that we need to keep growing the economy in order to create the funding base for investment in renewables and environmentally friendly technologies. But what that line of reasoning banks on is that we can continue growing the economy and somewhere down the line invest in these technologies to transform the economy. But if we don't, then we will be locked into runaway climate change and ecological collapse. And the other issue is that if we keep growing the economy, it will be impossible to scale up renewables to meet energy demand. What is needed, in addition to scaling up renewables, is just a direct curbing of economic activity so as to reduce the demand and make the transition possible.
And so we can express the goals of degrowth in terms of abundance. And the argument's been made for over 100 years by Marxists, socialists, people who've wanted to transform the capitalist system, that providing for the full spectrum of human needs is already in our hands. Fear of scarcity, like, is both real in human history, and it's also a historical, ideological product of how capitalism has changed our relationship to the natural world and how we get our material subsistence from it. And if we think about it, the capitalist system and the growth imperative behind it are themselves rooted in scarcity and the creation of artificial scarcities through enclosure, through property relations that prevent access to things that we could share and use in ways that don't produce profit, that don't produce sales. And the reality is we live in an abundant world that is held behind a system that creates scarcity, and that degrowth is about dismantling that system and attacking one of its most kind of critical ideological supports, which is that it has to keep expanding or there won't be anything for anyone.
Yeah, Jason Hickel reminds us that that word growth has become a kind of propaganda term. In reality, what's going on is a process of elite accumulation, the commodification of the commons, and the appropriation of human labor and natural resources, a process that's quite often colonial in character. And I also really appreciate Jason Hickel's defense of the use of the term degrowth, because it's a way of jarring people in or provoking people into thinking about what it means. By the use of the term degrowth, creating this environment where the problematic assumptions about growth can be discussed and debated.
It's important to understand that degrowth is not an abstract argument against growth. It is first situating growth in the history of capitalism as an imperial system that used force and violence to grow its economy by extracting labor and resources first from the peoples of Europe and then from the peoples of the Americas, Asia, and Africa, and Australia. And in that context, making the case for dismantling the growth-based economies of the global north, especially stopping the extraction of resources from the global south. So like you brought up earlier, degrowth is making the case for decolonizing the global economy. And it is also making the case that we need to restructure and scale down our economic activities to bring down the amounts of materials and the energy that we are extracting and the pollution that we are causing, not just in terms of the climate, but in terms of a spectrum of material and ecological systems and their boundaries and limits that we are brushing up against, if not surpassed.
Well, let's talk about what degrowth would look like and what it does look like in some instances.
If capitalism is able to spur growth by creating artificial scarcities, the biggest part of what degrowth will look like is making the abundance of social wealth realized for more people.
This will look like a job guarantee that will direct labor from sectors of the economy that we want and need to scale down into vitally needed projects of ecological restoration and providing for universal public services that will allow people to enjoy the benefits of our technological society without having to pay private companies for private products.
This looks like a universal basic income to offset the gaps in a program like that. But it also means looking at the profound waste of the capitalist system, and not just the kind of incidental waste that eco-modernists and some Marxists will assume can be taken care of with efficiency gains, but the kind of waste that is part of the power structure itself. When you look at, for example, the amounts of food that go to spoil and rot every year, we could cut our agricultural system almost in half and still be able to feed everybody. And in light of that, we have to ask ourselves, what is preventing everybody from being fed by the overabundant surpluses that we have, and see to it that while we degrow sectors of the economy, that what is actually available for the people's needs and desires is spread. With the job guarantee, there's also lots of talk about reducing work hours, both as a way to leverage down the output of the economy, but also to spread the work around and to create more time for non-market activities.
For living more slowly and being able to choose to use public transportation without lowering your quality of life, for choosing to cook for yourself rather than eat fast food without losing quality of life, and
more time for, you know, traditionally family, but expansive versions of families, community, civic and political engagement. And it also looks like, more wonkishly, abolishing planned obsolescence, legislating that manufacturers have to produce things in such a way that they can be easily repaired, and just improve like longevity standards,
so that we're not replacing things as much.
When we look at like kind of the social technologies that are available to us for reducing our consumption, rather than just kind of material technologies, libraries will have to be a larger part of how we share in the goods of our system, and socializing ownership and focusing on usership as kind of a consumer orientation to the stuff of the economy will go much further than technological changes to the commodity system we have now at averting climate catastrophes.
These are all great ideas and solutions. And I mean, I think we could keep going in terms of imagining or even plotting out how every aspect of our daily life might change for the better with these degrowth principles in mind. And I think we can look to some concrete examples, can't we? I mean, I'm immediately thinking about Cuba and how the country reoriented its priorities and focus, for example, to look at health and well-being. So here you have an impoverished island country that has made health and universal healthcare a priority. It has had one of the lowest rates of COVID in the hemisphere. It has one of the lowest infant mortality rates. It actually, because of its prioritizing medical care, has created this incredible infrastructure and even sends its healthcare professionals to other parts of the world that desperately need healthcare. So I think that's an example of how we could reimagine this refocus, moving away from the imperial war industrial complex to projects that really advance the well-being of everybody.
What Jason Hickel points out in his work on degrowth, he wrote a book called The Divide, and then more recently, Less is More, How Degrowth Will Save the Planet, that we have to think of degrowth in a global context. The fact that the Earth is imperiled is not a responsibility shared equally by all humans on the Earth, as is often kind of the trope of denigrating humanity for destroying the Earth or the Anthropocene. It's rather a specific kind of social system that has taken over the Earth in the last several hundred years. And so we need to look at the Global South, not just for the explicitly vanguard socialist projects like in Cuba, but for the fact that across the Global South, when countries were throwing off colonial shackles in the mid-20th century, they were throwing off and called to throw off by different theorists and political leaders of the time the growth imperatives that colonialism from European capitalist countries brought, and develop economies based around not just subsistence, but in Gandhi's words, permanence, creating self-sufficiency and
well-being,
and getting closer to the land and elevating the relationships of communal human life. And to modernize that, you know, we can look to examples like Cuba, but we can also look to how countries like Costa Rica also invest in healthcare and the population's health. And they don't have high GDPs. They have GDPs that are a fraction of the United States, and yet they have higher health outcomes. And this has to do with just this general ethic of care and stewardship that embody the way that the resources of the economy and all these different countries are shared.
And throughout this post-colonial period, but especially starting in the 1970s when global capital was slowing down again, you had international organizations dominated by former imperial powers like the IMF and World Bank, making these structural adjustment loans to former colonized countries to help develop their economies, on the condition that they abandon their well-being economics and promote privatization, free trade, and an economy based in capitalism.
This is Laurie Mercier with Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and we've been talking about degrowth as a movement for opposing capitalism and creating a sustainable and just world. You can hear more of this conversation and find lots of links to material about the degrowth movement when this show is posted on kboo.fm/oldmole in the next few days.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, I'd degrow that mountain down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a working class. Oh, I wish there's a working class. If there's a working class, I would have it in my hands, and I'd stop it squarely on a dime. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library. If there's a book in a library, then I'd finally be free. Oh, I wish there's a book in a library.
And there's struggles over this, even. For example, in Bolivia, we've covered on the Old Mole how this heroic indigenous-led socialist party who came in with massive support and got to changing the economy and reducing poverty, but then also doing that on the back of the growth system, the extractive mineral economy, and were facing and have faced internal opposition around how that has come at the expense of the peoples of Bolivia and the environment. As we reduce our demand in the global north for the products of the global south, there can be transformations in the global south of their economies away from basically paying tribute to the imperial nations of the global north and can focus on their own development. You know, the global south, and Marxists have made this case, you know, for a long time too, that we will need to ramp up the means of production in a lot of places so that we can actually share the potential of a post-scarcity society. If released from the compulsion to feed capitalism as controlled by the global north, they will have both the resources domestically and the headroom, as it were, to develop their own economies around distributing the wealth of their societies in a more equitable way. It's going to be a global effort. We can't really have degrowth in one country because the thing that needs to degrow isn't limited to one country.
And it also really insists that those of us in the global north push back against our imperialistic governments that continue to intervene in those regions on behalf of global capital. So halting that kind of imperialist war machine is really critical to the degrowth movement. Joe, are there any other ways? I mean, we have plenty of models, I think. Are there other ways that we can more quickly get to this new growth? I mean, to the degrowth model.
There are, but they will take political will. David Graeber, who passed away late last year and was famous for helping spearhead the Occupy movement, made a huge part of his intellectual career around understanding debt and ultimately came to argue for the idea of a debt jubilee as a way that we could instantly remove the pressure to keep ratcheting up the economy to pay off debts, which now, you know, are in the trillions of dollars for peoples all over the world. That's one way. And people have been agitating for that since Occupy Wall Street. And it's important even in calls to like abolish student debt, which gets called classist for supposedly only helping people who are in the position to go into higher education. But it has a broader impact on the way that the economy works. we can agitate for our governments to reject GDP as a government objective. Iceland and New Zealand have done this, and China has also come out as saying that it will no longer use GDP as its main one of its main indicators of what it needs to do as an economy. And this is important because we need to value the earth, and we cannot value the earth if we value the exchange value of produced goods in the economy.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for illuminating some of these important principles of degrowth and the ways in which we might envision a better world through degrowth. This has been Laurie Mercier and Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And then thanks again, Joe, for initiating this conversation about degrowth. We're going to link to some resources to learn more on the Old Mole website.